Become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. United. It's a night of big-time directors on the show. Tonight we have director Paul Schrader, who will talk about his new film, The Canyons, James Ponsoldt, whose new film is the eagerly anticipated film, The Spectacular Now, and Fernando Trueba, the Oscar-winning director of a new film called The Artist and the Model, The Packed Show. And we also have great movie discussion, reviews of the latest releases, and all the good stuff that you normally rely on Movie Geeks for. But let's get to our first featured guest tonight. Several years ago, this gentleman joined us after we did a special tribute show on his work, and it was a memorable interview, wasn't it, Jerry?
Oh, it was, by all means. I can't wait to hear what he has to say about the canyons and everything, but it was one of my favorite interviews, without a doubt.
Yeah, and a good like projection of the future of movies that he gave us probably like 5 years ago. We talk a little bit about this in this interview because his new film, The Canyons, deals in some part with that theme, the death of movies. The Canyon stars Lindsay Lohan and James Dean. It's currently available on demand across the country. It will be in theaters at the end of the month. And, of course, Paul Schrader is the screenwriter of classics like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, and he's directed groundbreaking movies that have really informed the culture, like American Gigolo, for instance. And so we talk about his latest film and a lot of what's going on in Hollywood today. Here's Paul Schrader.
Kickstarter Productions presents the year's most anticipated film from the Twitter-obsessed pen of author Bret Easton Ellis by the never-nominated director Paul Schrader.
I guess I'd like to keep some parts of my life private.
Nobody has a private life anymore, Tara.
Leave him. Get out of there.
I'm with him now. I'm with him.
If you ever see him again, I will kill him.
He's not going to let the movie happen.
I don't care how much I have to degrade myself. I will beg him to keep the movie going.
I need something from you.
What do you want, huh?
What are you doing?
I trusted you, and you lied to me!
The Canyons, in CinemaScope and Technicolor, starring Lindsay Lohan. As Tara, a sensuous woman torn between two loves, and introducing James Dean as Christian.
I guess, first of all, I wanted to know from you how you believe or where you believe that your creative sensibilities and those of Bret Easton Ellis's are simpatico.
Well, you know, there's a generational difference. There's a generational difference between Bret and I and then between Bret and the characters in this movie. But I think that, I like his his characters. I like his dialogue. You know, we were supposed to do another film that fell apart, and I got in touch with him, and I said, you know, fuck it, Brad. You know, I like the stuff you write. Well, let's just do something together, and we'll pay for it ourselves. So that's how it all started. You know, he thinks the film is more me than him. I think it's more him than me. So I guess that's the definition of a good collaboration.
And the truth is probably, you know, in the middle. So you talk about a generational difference, and, you know, you came up in the youth-driven Hollywood of the 70s, and when you compare that time to this time, how is it different?
Well, there's the three big generational shifts. My generation, obviously, was, you know, the kind of protest, cultural revolution generation, you know, very idea-driven. And Brett's American Psycho generation is extremely materialistic. And this current generation is almost in a kind of post-materialistic sort of haze. In other words, they're doing all the materialistic things, but they're not enjoying it. When we had our first rehearsal, I said to the cast, I said, this is a movie about 20-somethings in Los Angeles who got in line to see a film, and then the theater closed. But they stayed in line because they had nowhere else to go.
Mm.
And so, you know, so these are kids who are making a movie that don't really like movies. These are kids who are hooking up, you know, who really, you know, aren't in love, you know. It is a rather bleak picture that Brad painted with this script. It's not necessarily one I could have written.
But do you think that feeling of apathy, which absolutely wasn't part of your generation, I mean, your generation was very active in what was going on in the world, and your art reflected that. But do you feel that
we can make the world better. There's nobody today who actually thinks anything's going to get any better. In fact, they all believe everything's going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, last time we spoke, you one of the provocative statements you made was that you believe that movies were dead or were dying, and I see that reflected in this film and the themes that you just expressed, but also your transitions are old abandoned movie houses. Go ahead.
That's that theme of people who are doing movies, but, you know, I mean, just like their sex lives are dead, the movies are dead. Now, you know, you have to be a little careful when you define movies. But by movies, I mean the projected image in front of an audience in a dark room. I mean, I think that's going away. So in my very first email to Brett, when I proposed this idea, I said, let's do cinema for a post-theatrical era. And that turned out to be exactly what we're doing. You know, we are opening up in some theaters in a couple of weeks. But, you know, this is designed for post-theatrical cinema. And, you know, the term straight-to-video has no meaning anymore because, we're going out on every venue, just like Nick Reffin's film this weekend.
Yeah, unbelievable. And last weekend we had a De Niro Travolta movie that premiered at home. So
yeah.
It is absolutely a changing landscape. But here's a question I had for you, because The Canyon started getting wide press, you know, before you guys even started production on it. By the way, you were raising funds for it, and then it got another dose of press from the casting of Lindsay Lohan. Were you ever afraid that that kind of attention was bound to overshadow the film itself, or did you welcome it?
Yeah, you welcomed it because you don't have a choice. You know, the magic word now in Hollywood is noise. Does this idea have noise? Well, you know, I'm making this film on a micro budget, just like 10,000 other people are right now. Which film is going to get its head above the crowd? Well, it's going to be the film with some noise. And how do you get noise? Well, you know, there's different ways, but in the end, you know, the noise is good because you have to believe the film will stand on its own. But it won't stand on its own if nobody sees it.
Yeah.
And so you start to kind of stir the pot. You know, we've had a Facebook chronicle of the making of the film. In our new media era, you have to just—it's not the idea of holding something back, which was the old idea, has now been replaced by scattergunning. The media all the time. Because, you know, there aren't any major media outlets left. There isn't the cover of Time magazine anymore. You know, there isn't, you have to scattergun. And, of course, when you do that, you know, there are going to be the Perez Hiltons of this world who, really ridicule you. But then, you know, that's their game anyway. You know, better to have them ridicule you than ignore you.
Right, right. But what's most fascinating to me about this movie is there's a kind of meta aspect to it. What it says about celebrity is inherent in the casting itself, because Lindsay and James Dean, they both represent something specific to how we use celebrity today.
One's an icon of celebrity culture, and the other is an icon of the adult culture. And so therefore that's a very interesting pairing, because people are going to say, well, you know, what happens when these two things get together? So that's inherently interesting. And then with the umbrella of myself and Brett, it makes it even more interesting. So yes, it was designed to get people's attention that way. As soon as Lindsay started coming on board, I hadn't thought about casting James seriously. I screen tested him; he was very good. But when she started coming on board, I said, "You know, this whole notion of post empire that Brett has, this is post empire casting." You know, I mean, we called the film a post empire production. He believes we are in a post empire art world now, where the American century is over, and we're now making art out of the crap that's left over, just like Britain did last century. And so the idea of collecting the discards of culture and making a post-empire art is exactly what we were kind of after with that casting.
I have one last question for you, because I know you're pressed for time, but kind of getting back to the generational difference, your reasoning for making films today, is the thing that turned you on about making films the same now as it was when you started?
No. I'm getting ready to do another film, but obviously, I'm getting to the end of my career, and so you're no longer interested in making an impression, but you're trying to sort of pull some things together that you've always been interested in. Although in The Canyons, actually, part of the real interest in this was, can you make a film this way? Obviously, I was interested in making this film, but I was equally interested in whether it was even possible. You know, can you do it a DIY? And how do you do it? And so that was one of the great attractions of this whole project. And basically, we got lucky. You know, we went into the casino, we put everything on red, the wheel came up red. And if we have any brains, we'll get out of the casino now.
So you're not anxious to go this route again?
Well, I'm not planning on it. If these circumstances arose again, where you saw a kind of confluence of interest at a micro-budget level that would be really fascinating, yes, I would do it in a heartbeat. But I wouldn't try to force. It has to be there. It has to, you know, feel genuine.
Yeah.
You can't just say, you know, let's make a film for $100,000 because we want to. You have to say, you know, does this really make sense to do? And like the next film I'm doing, there's no way it would be any good if done under this model.
Mm. And that's the one with Nicolas Cage you've cast?
Yeah.
Okay.
It hasn't been announced yet, but it's there.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you giving me time today. Your movies have meant so much to me in my life, and I appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Okay, that was Paul Schrader. The film is The Canyons. It's available now on demand. It opens in limited release in theaters nationwide at the end of the month.
There's so many interesting movies that he's directed. I mean, the things that he's written alone, that would be enough for most people, but it's just the stuff that he's directed. Like, Affliction is definitely one of those, but like the Comfort of Strangers, Light mm-hmm. Sleeper. That one he did, I think it was before, after The Closer with Woody Harrelson. That's a good
one,
too.
Yeah, The Walker.
The Walker, yeah. I'm sorry, The Walker, I'm sorry. You got to forgive me, I don't...
I just saw that last year, and I liked it very much. I've always liked The Comfort of Strangers. There's something to be said about The Comfort of Strangers because it's the only movie that Christopher Walken said disturbed him.
Oh, wow.
My father was a very big man. All his life, he wore a black mustache. When it turned gray, he used a little brush to keep it black, such as ladies use for their eyes, mascara. Everyone was afraid of him. My mother and my four sisters, at the dining table, you could not speak unless spoken to first by my father, but he loved me. I was his favorite. He was a diplomat all his life. We spent years in London, Knightsbridge. Every morning, he got out of bed at 6 o'clock and went to the bathroom to shave. No one was allowed out of bed until he'd finished.
Do you recall that film, Dean, The Comfort of Strangers?
You know, that's one of the ones that I still haven't seen. There's a few of them I haven't seen. I haven't seen Touch or Light Sleeper or the Exorcist prequel or even Adam Resurrected. I haven't seen that either.
That's the one I haven't seen yet. Adam Resurrected, I still need to see.
My memories of Paul Schrader as a director are really like more up towards the beginning of his directing career. I mean, I still think his debut film, Blue Collar, is his best movie, and then I would throw Hardcore in right after that, and then I have a big, you know, I think Mishima is just brilliant.
Oh, Mishima is a masterpiece.
Yeah, it is, and it's. I think it's his best looking movie too. But there's a lot of the ones. But you're right, Affliction is one of his best.
I think he's going back to. They've remastered Cat People. And I think he's going back to work on that too.
He's
trying to convince Criterion to do something with some more of his movies. Like The Comfort of Strangers and that sort of thing.
I would recommend The Comfort, yeah.
You know, and I always loved Hardcore as well, and because I definitely wanted to ask him about Hardcore the last interview we did, and I did ask him that, and he kind of seemed to, you could tell it was a little bit of a sour subject. You could tell that movie didn't turn out the way he wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So.
I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, people kind of, and the movie has kind of a strange, I don't know how to put this, but it has a strange sense of irony to it in some ways. Or there's like a little bit of a comedy edge to it, like a very, very dark comedy edge to it that's kind of weird. It's weird to say that, but when I think about it, you know, I think about the scenes with, you know, Big Dick Black and then some of Susan Hubley's, you know,
I am definitely pulling that for a soundbite.
But what about Autofocus?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Autofocus.
No, Autofocus really. Yeah, the first time you watch it, because I feel like me, you go in with very high expectations, and you're like, what I'm amazed about the film, here 11 years later, is the film resonates more with me as time goes by. I think it's a very powerful film, and the interplay between William Dafoe and Greg Kinnear is, I have to say, by today's standards, classic. There's
mm-hmm.
something, I mean, they have great on-screen chemistry, and I think Greg Kinnear, that's the transformational role for him.
It's a critical time for me. I need something big.
This could be what you're looking for.
This character, Hogan, he's quick on his toes, he's hip, he's a con artist,
but I think it's what I've been working toward my whole career.
I am such a fan. I just wonder...
A picture together? You betcha.
Smile.
Photography's always been my thing. I'm Bob Crane.
John Carpenter. I'm a real gone
lover. If you like photography, you wouldn't believe this new equipment they sent me.
It'll blow your mind.
What will we do with it?
Home movies.
One of my clients is having a party up in the hills on Friday. Could be fun.
Are you seeing another woman?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
What's your secret? Three words. Don't make waves.
You're a fortunate man.
Yes, I am.
Schrader is definitely one of the darkest of all filmmakers. I mean, there's, outside of Hardcore, which, I think a lot of the laughs in that maybe are not intentional, but, and maybe that's the thing that Paul Schrader doesn't like about the film. But there are not a lot of laughs in his movies. I mean, it's a pretty dark and dire bunch of films there, so,
Which is so weird, because when you're like Facebook friends with Paul Schrader, and he posts pictures of him, dancing at his daughter's wedding and that kind of stuff, it's kind of an odd sight.
You're shocked because I took credit for your idea. Honestly, I would expect you to do the exact same thing in my place. I wanted New York, but I wasn't counting on it. And thanks to you, I got my shot and I took it. I mean, there's no backstabbing here. This is business, Isabel. And we're all on the same team. You have talent. I made the best use of it. So thank you. Now, tell me. How was London?
We got weird time in movies since we've got new films from Paul Schrader and Brian De Palma on demand now.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the De Palma film.
Oh, yeah? Passion. What'd you think?
I thought it was fine. It was a lot of people say that it's closest to Body Double in tone, and I do kind of see that, because it's it definitely plays like an 80s erotic thriller.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
It's got that Cinemax sheen.
Mm-hmm.
But which is
that sort
say
of Euro, that Euro trashy kind of thing going on through it.
It's he wrote the screenplay based on the Love Crime, the movie that from 2010. I liked it. I thought the film was gorgeously photographed, even though the De Palma-isms don't really kick into high gear until a little over halfway through the film, and then
right.
then you become disoriented. You don't quite know what's going on, and I don't know that I quite knew what was going on by the time the movie ended either. So I kind of want to go back and watch it again, but it does seem like De Palma's tropes are there, even to the last shot. And
mm-hmm.
the Pino Donaggio music going dun 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 dun, and then ending abruptly, but to lesser effect than in his other movies.
Right.
And that's why I think people are saying it seems like De Palma's aping himself, which he's done for years, but I think more effectively he's done it in the past.
Right. Compared to the last two movies, The Black Dahlia and The Redacted, where do you think it ranks? I'm gonna hope I can watch it this week. But where do you think it ranks as far as those two go?
Well, it's just good to see him back on that ground.
I don't think it's more pure De Palma than those two movies are. You know, I mean, if you like De Palma, it's really got all of those things. It's like a De Palma fan film or something, you know?
That's the impression I'm under.
It's got the twin sort of thing going on, and it's got the you know, split screen and the Pino Donaggio score and just that sort of I don't know, slight coldness to it that
let me see this.
Yeah, it's good. I liked it. I thought it was fun.
Okay.
I
like that we live in, and I say this, I'm Facebook friends with Monty Hellman, so I'll say this. I like that Monty Hellman and Brian De Palma are still making movies, that they're still in the game. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I love that Paul Schrader is still making movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good sign.
I mean, I'd give Passion something like a B-minus or something. The Donaggio score isn't as distinctive as it is in previous collaborations. I think it actually distracts from the movie in some way and makes it play a lot cheesier than... I think it really gives it that cheesy, cheap quality. I do think the two actresses are really fun together and so beautifully photographed. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Rachel McAdams is photographed. That's the most porcelain skin you'll ever see on film.
Yeah.
It's Rachel McAdams in that movie. And there is one sequence that comes close to getting you thrilled about seeing a De Palma sequence in action, which is when he employs the split screen and there's a big murder. But it doesn't come close to his other sequences of note. And at least the Black Dahlia had a sequence that I think is actually better when Aaron Eckhart falls over the balcony and Hilary Swank has the blade and she's in shadow and he's running up the staircase.
That's the most memorable scene in the movie, yeah.
I like that movie. I hate that movie, but I love that movie because there's so much great De Palma tropes in that movie. But it's not a great movie, but I just love watching it, though.
You'll love Passion, man. I mean, it's
well, let me ask you guys this, though.
Sort of funny. I like it because it's kind of it's almost De Palma kind of making fun of himself, kind of in a little way.
Well,
you know?
I thought the Black Dahlia was that, but let me ask you this though. Let me ask. It's just when we had De Palma on the show, his next film it looked like was going to be a prequel to The Untouchables. Are you happier with this film than any kind of prequel to The Untouchables?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it's hard to say.
I don't know what The Untouchables would have been. In some ways, I think that I think that The Untouchables, I loved it when it first came out, and the more I have watched it over the years, the less I like it. And I think it's because of the screenplay. There seems to be some rah-rah, very straight arrow tone to the screenplay that's completely antithetical to what you associate with David Mamet, usually.
But that is David Mamet now. You realize that is David Mamet
now,
right?
At least.
Yeah, it is now. But back then, I mean, this isn't the guy that wrote Glengarry Glenn Ross that wrote The Untouchables. I'm sorry.
Right, exactly. You're right. You're right about that.
Or American Buffalo or Edmund or any of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or The Verdict. But even though The Verdict is, in its own way, it's kind of like a inspirational and anthemic, but a lot more muted.
Well, we should remember that he's in both of these places, in Untouchables and in The Verdict. He's a screenwriter for hire. He's doing what I think he's being asked to do.
Right.
So,
I feel like the more I watch Untouchables, the more I feel like it's a little limp. So I don't know if I would have been excited about a prequel to it. I was talking to Aaron about this last night. It interests me how De Palma, because De Palma can't make a movie without implanting his own unique point of view on it.
Well, which is more than anything else.
What defines a great director. However, I'm always interested how he would do a straight drama and how he would make it distinctive in his own voice. And that's why his next project, that Happy Valley about Sandusky and Paterno, that project completely fascinates me, De Palma's involvement in that. And Aaron was thinking, well, maybe it's a Rashomon thing. Maybe it's like how various people viewed this event. Or maybe it's not. Like, how would De Palma do doing a straight drama? Because he did comedies, and those were flops, and he admits that those were his least successful films, just in terms of a creative standpoint,
mm-hmm.
because he couldn't incorporate his personal, you know, voice in those.
Mm-hmm. Are we talking about the mob movie of Danny DeVito and Joe Piscopo?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but I mean, those were his like straight comedies. I mean, he does very subversive humor in all of his movies.
Yeah,
so, yeah. I mean, he's always been blackly funny. Scarface is blackly
right.
funny, you know. So,
mm-hmm. Scarface.
But how would he be doing a straightforward drama, as it sounds like Happy Valley will be?
I don't know if he has that in him, really. I mean, and I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm just saying, I can't imagine a De Palma movie that doesn't have his imprimatur on it. So I just, if it happens, that'd be interesting. I mean, I think Redacted is about as far as De Palma has strayed away from, you know, the De Palmaisms. I think that's...
Not really. It shows a love of, if anything, you know, I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, and I said it before on the show. I mean, Redacted really shows his love of Stanley Kubrick.
There's so many
homages to Paths of Glory in the movie. I mean, just the way shots are framed and everything, it does remind me of Paths of Glory, and I mean that in a very nice way. De Palma's made one of the great anti-war films, Casualties of War.
Well, what I'm really pointing to and mentioning Redacted as being something that's farther away from normal De Palma than I'm used to, is just the faux documentary quality of it.
Go back to his early days of Greetings and Hi Mom and The Wedding Party?
Those aren't really faux documentaries in the sense they're just low budget movies that are kind of part of the whole sixties to seventies sort of transition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
and you know, I mean, they're shot on the streets and so forth, but Redacted, you know, is really a true like faux documentary in a lot of ways, and I don't really see that in a lot of his other movies. So that's why I say that it's farther away from.
No, it's
what
not
I'm
a great film, but I think you should be applauded for taking that, for trying to do something new.
I agree.
In that phase of his life, I mean. He obviously wanted to speak out against the Iraq war at the time, and he's got to be applauded for it. And, I mean, more power to him, because no one else in his generation was even going close to that. You know, De Palma was the only one of his generation really trying to make a statement. I applaud him for that. I don't like the film, mind you. I don't think it's a very good film at all, but I will give him total props for, like, speaking it out.
It's a brave and daring movie. And it fits the themes that, you know, it, thematically, it's a De Palma film. It's just, as Dean said, stylistically, what he wanted to do with it, it isn't cinematic. I mean, it's new media. I think the big challenge for him, the big turn-on for him, was adding all these different media together. Mm-hmm. And there's touches of that in Passion as well. I mean, technology plays a big part in that film. Everyone's on their iPhone, everyone's, you know, security cameras and all this kind of internet.
It's a big plot point, you know.
He made a statement that he wouldn't want to work in film, or he wouldn't want to work in TV. But even though he admits that TV is a great medium now and it's a very exciting time for TV, but TV wouldn't allow him the feeling of cinema that he gets on a big screen. It wouldn't play to his strengths.
I would give him, if he would go on TV... If I was the showrunner of True Blood, I would say, could you please take over the next season? You can direct every episode, have your way with it. Oh, my God. I'd give him whatever he wanted.
With Happy Valley, because there's also a big streak of perversion in his films, obviously.
And that
could be very combustible with De Palma telling the Sandusky story.
Right.
I mean, that could really be a controversial movie because of De Palma's involvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who will play Sandusky?
No, I agree.
I mean, who would be brave enough to, you know, what actor would be brave enough to take that role on? My God.
Alec Baldwin. I can't possibly begin to cast it because I've only got the slightest idea of what this whole Sandusky thing is, you know, kind of stayed away from that story.
Well, you know why I say Alec Baldwin? Because I say it because of Canteen Boy on Saturday Night Live.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Well, I mean, Paterno's obviously Pacino, which is, I think, good casting. There is a list online of who should play Sandusky in a film. Craig T. Nelson? Yeah.
Oh, Cozy would be perfect. Oh, my God. That would be too much of an inside-y kind of joke, though, wouldn't it?
It'd be great. What's he doing? I mean, what's he been doing lately?
He doesn't look too different from Sandusky. And he gives off this trustworthy vibe, but it has to be a major pervert and child molester on the side. I mean, it's a role that's really going to be difficult to cast, I think. Nick Nolte, you could believe that.
Oh, I have no trouble with that. That seems like a good choice. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the guy right now, so...
Are
you in the room with him? I mean, what the hell is going on, Dean?
I'm looking at Sandusky online and just
taking a look at, you know, just visually, you know. I mean,
this guy I cannot imagine, and that's Brian Dennehy. I can't imagine him showing a side like that. But
maybe Hungry Man TV dinners, but I mean, you know.
I think he's a little, it's like, Dennehy might be a little too heavy for that role.
You know, I don't think Dennehy can do that. Dennehy can do a lot of things. He wouldn't be the guy I'd go to for that. I just wouldn't think of that. I mean, Patrick Warbottom, definitely, but I'm not Brian Dennehy.
Bill Murray.
Oh, God, that could work. Oh, my God. Well, they're really sad. I can see that.
Pacino's shooting this new movie called Imagine, where he plays this ex-rock star that kind of charts a new course in his life after finding a letter that John Lennon wrote to him. And it's a directorial, I don't know if it's the debut, it's the guy that wrote Crazy Stupid Love. And so he wrote this one and is directing it. But apparently there's a big concert scene where Pacino goes up and he sings a song in front of a big audience. And they shot that Friday night at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
In the intermission of an actual concert that Chicago was giving. And then so they have that online of them shooting the scene of Pacino performing. And then they brought Pacino on for the finale of them playing 25 or 6 to 4. And
mm-hmm.
It's like 8 minutes of watching Pacino like really dance on stage as Chicago is playing this song. Oh, my God. It's great. It looks like this guy's having a great time. And he actually looks better than he has in a few years in movies
mm-hmm.
on stage up there. So that could be a good movie. I hope it is.
He's been doing a lot more comedy recently.
Yeah.
He seems to be.
Then his next movie is the David Gordon Green Manglehorn movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which is a heavy drama, I think. So, Jerry, you saw Blue Jasmine.
Yes, I did. It's, you know, a lot of people want to say it's Woody Allen's best film. I don't know about that. But, you know, as my mom pointed out today, she goes, I didn't laugh once during the movie. And, you know, it's not that kind of Woody Allen movie. It is a serious drama. I don't think I've ever seen anyone play Blanche DuBois quite like Kate Blanchett since Vivian Leigh. It's amazing. Her performance is amazing, but everyone's performance in the movie is incredible, especially Andrew Dice Clay. I mean, you can't rule him out. I mean, I guess you people want to say she's playing Ruth Madoff, and that's certainly true at the start, maybe.
but it takes a completely different course. And I can't talk a lot about it because what happens, what transpires through the movie is there is something that happens in the third act that I did not expect. That twist that happens is one of those, you know, oh my God moments. Cate Blanchett is definitely going to get a Best Actress nomination. I would be really shocked if she doesn't.
Of course not. What on earth makes you think that?
Well, someone made a remark.
What remark?
They saw you having lunch with her, taking her hand.
Oh, what crap. Who told you that? I know who. It was that vacuous troublemaker, Lydia. Am I right?
Were you?
It had to be Lydia because I was having a business lunch with Amy at the Four Seasons.
Did
and Lydia
you
was there.
Take her hand?
Are you nuts? You think if I was having an affair, I'd be crazy enough to have it in public at the Four Seasons?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you drink at lunch. No, maybe you're high. I mean, it's obvious she's got a crush on you.
Honey, you're building a case.
Because if you were having an affair, I would be pretty upset.
Well, I'm not, so don't get your temper up. I don't like that side of you.
But your feelings about Cate Blanchett will change. They go up and down. Like her character, your emotional response to her will go up and down throughout the movie. Jamie, let's be honest. This guy, the ratio of good movies to bad movies is unparalleled. I mean,
yeah, especially if you like Woody Allen. Yeah, I mean, there are some people that can't tolerate anything he produces. But there is something about, from my understanding of it, this movie speaks more of class than most, if any, movie he's ever done.
Well, he does.
This movie
says more about class than any movie I've ever seen. This movie, you're right about that, about Woody Allen, but just in general, I mean, it's amazing.
Well, he doesn't do a lot of movies that take place in middle class or lower middle class surroundings, and so
mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting that most of this movie actually takes place in that world, you know, since it takes place, you know, in. Sally Hawkins is her sister, plays her sister, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's not rich at all. I mean,
relationship is fascinating within itself. I mean, forget everything else.
Won't it be something else if Andrew Dice Clay gets a Best Supporting Actor nomination?
It's possible.
It's possible.
It's not outside the realm of possibility, but that's just a crazy notion. I mean, that's just pretty great.
Well, what was it? Was it his stint on Entourage that brought him back into the limelight?
Yeah, that's actually where Woody Allen saw him.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Bob Thornton, the Coen brothers are moving to TV. I think they're just probably producing this. They're making a TV series out of their movie Fargo, and Billy Bob Thornton will star in it. So it'll be Billy Bob Thornton's entry into network television. That's certainly a specific world in Fargo that you can imagine being explored in multiple episodes with colorful characters.
Right.
That show sounds like a really good idea. The fact that they're, you know, just, you know, they're taking a whole other crime. You know, it's all, you know, there's no characters from the movie in it, as far as I know. Although it would be interesting if Frances McDormand pops up in it in one scene or one episode, but I think that's a really, really interesting idea. There's a lot of movies now that are being considered to be, you know, as possible vehicles for television shows now. That's a big thing that's happening. So you'll see a lot more of those. And then also, I just read this great article on New York Times about how the movie studios are now going through their back catalogs and trying to find more movies to transfer into Broadway musicals. So I think
I saw that too. I don't know.
They're talking about doing The Sting as a musical, which I can see. I mean, It'd be interesting if they would do some of these as just straight plays. I think it'd be fascinating. There was one that they mentioned that I thought, oh, boy, that'd be better just as a play. Well, now they're talking about, you know, Universal's doing Animal House and Back to the Future and The Sting as musicals, 20th Century Fox doing Mrs. Doubtfire, Devil Wears Prada, and Waitress. That's a surprising one.
I think now we're getting out of hand, though. I mean, it just sounds like...
Well, keep listening. Sony is doing Tootsie, Warner Brothers, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Well, that makes kind of sense. And then they're also talking about doing Magic Mike as a stage, which is weird because why would you do Magic Mike instead? Why? I mean, if you were going to go see Magic Mike, and theoretically you would think that it was mostly women going to see it, why wouldn't you just go to a real strip club or whatever? It's like going to a strip club, but. You know, not really. So you don't have the onus of like, oh, swinking into the strip club.
Well, Chippendales doesn't give you a story.
true.
And they don't sing their own numbers. I'm surprised Flashdance was never made into a Broadway musical.
Are you sure that it wasn't?
I don't know. I don't think so. They made Carrie into a Broadway musical. And they did that in the 70s, and it was like such a disaster. And then they remounted it a few years back and had slightly more success because they reconfigured it, but it still didn't do very well. They did, The Exorcist is a stage play. They did that with Brooke Shields a couple of years ago in L.A.
Wow. Huh. I didn't
Brooke
know
Shields
that
the Exorcist.
That's weird. I didn't know that they had this season they're doing Rocky, Bridges of Madison County, Bullets Over Broadway, and Big Fish as musicals.
Wow.
And American Psycho.
Wow, that's really jumped the shark.
What movie would you like to see as a Broadway musical?
Well, you know, they should do Moulin Rouge. I don't know why nobody has done that. But that's already a musical. So let me try and pick a drama that I think would be.
Five Minutes in the Summer.
Mm-hmm. As a musical.
As a musical, just to be in the spirit of the spectacular now this week, you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Have they ever done Casablanca as a musical on stage? It seems impossible.
Why don't they do Lawrence of Arabia? The thing is, a musical.
Could work as a musical because wasn't it based on it was based on a movie, but I think the movie Everybody Comes to Rick was based on a stage play. So, and plus it is kind of it takes place in only one place. So
dun 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 dun,
you know.
Dun dun. Of all the gin joints in all the world, why does she have to walk into mine? Dun, 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 dun.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think this is really, you know, I do think, I know, I saw this article too, and I read it, and I just think it really just debases all the movies personally, but.
I got one. Brazil. Brazil should be done as a musical.
If it makes people go watch the movie, I'm fine with it.
I think you're totally against the whole musical thing, aren't you?
It's not that I'm against it. But don't you think, though, it shows the same lack of creativity, the same lack of resources that's in the movie business?
Well, the one place that it does show creativity is that it's very difficult to transfer the feeling of a film onto a stage, especially considering a film like, you know, has so many set changes and so forth. So there is a challenge to it.
Showa the musical. That's what I want. Showa the musical. I want that.
That would really work well on Broadway.
With music by the band Survivor.
Classic. I love it. I love it.
You know, Manilow has an original musical, and he's had an impossible time getting it on Broadway. Nobody wants to do original anything anymore. They want to do revivals, or they want to do musicals based on premises that we already know.
And I guess that's about to, since we were just talking about it, that feeling is about to infect television as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because TV is... The big revival of TV has largely sidestepped this feeling of wanting to take something that previously exists and expand upon it. But it looks like it's going to happen there as well.
Well, speaking of movies and TV, the biggest TV event of the year that deals with movies, obviously, is the Oscars every year. And they announced that Ellen DeGeneres will return as the host of next year's Oscars.
That's a good choice. That's a great choice.
She was good last time she did it. I mean, people are saying, "Oh, it's a safe choice and everything." Yeah, it's a safe choice, but she is generally well liked, and I think, you know, say what you will, it's going to maybe sound like a big old fuddy-duddy, but you know, I don't really think that the Oscars are the place to go out and do edgy stuff.
She's great. She's an awesome choice. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, her daytime show is she has succeeded where everyone else has failed. So I give more props to her.
Her show is great. Her show is awesome.
She succeeded where Rosie O'Donnell could not, and what was the other one? Rachel Ray. You know, whatever you will about these shit, she succeeded. Her show is perfect. I mean, she has the perfect daytime talk show. So good for her, and I'm happy that she's going to go back to the Oscars because she just does this so well.
But she's writing her "We Saw Your Boobs" montage right now.
I'm sure she'll be making a joke about that.
EW did a list ranking the best hosts of the past 20 years. At number 11, they had the duo Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin, which I didn't think they did bad.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to introduce actor, writer, musician, Grammy and Emmy winner, one of the most enduring entertainers of all time, Mr. Steve Martin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. And this is Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, I think they deserve to be higher.
Yeah.
I think so, too, especially since their number 10 is Franco and Hathaway.
What? That's ridiculous. Okay.
They shouldn't even be on a goddamn list. I mean, really?
Their number 9 is Whoopi Goldberg.
See, I like her too. I've gone back and taken a look at some clips, and I find that even looking at the clips now, I think that she's pretty funny.
Their number 8 is Jon Stewart. Their number 7 is David Letterman. Their number 6 is Seth MacFarlane. Their number 5 is Chris Rock. 4 is Billy Crystal. Go ahead. You thought Chris Rock was what?
I thought Chris Rock didn't work at all.
I thought he was fine. I mean, you know, for what it is, I thought he was fine. But
that's right. There's no acting at the Oscars. None at all. You go to the Grammys, they're singing. You go to the Tony Awards, they singing and dancing. You go to the Source Awards, they singing, dancing, and shooting, okay? But there's no acting at the Oscars at all. Can I get a little acting? Just a to be or not to be, a Morgan Freeman do a shampoo commercial, something, right? Like, the only acting you ever see at the Oscars is when people act like they're not mad they lost. Like, I remember one year when Halle Berry won the Oscar, Nicole Kidman was smiling so wide, she should have won an Emmy at the Oscars for her great performance.
Their number 3 is Hugh Jackman. Their number 2 is Ellen DeGeneres. And their number 1 is Steve Martin when he was solo.
I agree.
Yeah.
However, my number 1 would be Hugh Jackman. For whatever reason, just the production of that show alone and the pace of it and the job that he did. I liked that telecast a lot.
Right, yeah. Right. Me too. I would put him at number two. That was he's the one that most successfully incorporated music into the thing. You know.
Yeah.
I think. And comedy. He seems like somebody that can do it, really do it all.
Why didn't you burn the tapes?
I don't know what I'm supposed to say here.
18 minutes, all erased.
I mean, it's an honor. I just would have loved a heads up.
America deserves an apology.
Frank Langello was sitting right next to me.
Stop your lies right now and tell the truth.
Jackman.
It's Frost. Confess to me.
Why can't you let this be? Give me my dignity.
Look what you've done to me.
But for me, Steve Martin, and I know he would never agree to do this, but he's the one that should take up the mantle of you know, the Bob Hope, Billy Crystal kind of thing, because I think he's really, he's not only, he's funny, really funny, of course, but he's also extremely classy, too. And,
yeah, I think so, too.
So, mm-hmm.
Hollywood Reporter did something on the fall movie season, and if we thought the summer season was overloaded, fall looks equally overloaded.
Mm-hmm.
Within the next 6 weeks, studios will open Ron Howard's race car movie, Rush, the space thriller Gravity, Justin Timberlake and Ben Affleck in Runner Runner, Somalian pirate drama Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks, the WikiLeaks biopic The Fifth Estate, Robert Redford's All Is Lost, Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, Ridley Scott's The Counselor with Brad Pitt and Michael Fassbender, Insidious Chapter 2, Machete Kills, Carrie, Prisoners with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal, on and on and on.
Well, some of those are not really prestige movies, like Runner Runner or Machete.
Yeah,
they're just
talking about movies. They're not talking about Oscar
winners.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. But
I think some of those may get pushed back too, though. I really do.
Well, some have already been pushed back to that period of time. I mean, Carrie was supposed to come out in February.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're going to get like four or five movies opening in every weekend, which, that is weird. It's overload for sure. But on the positive side, the great thing about, you know, when September rolls around is that, you know, for me personally, at least, I can finally go back to the movies and actually feel like I'm going to see something that's worthwhile. And I will say this, from the spring to the summer, as I said at the beginning of the summer, I said, I just don't think I'm going to go to the movies this summer. I just don't see anything I'm excited about. And it's pretty much remained so. There's not a lot out there for me. So I can catch up now and get my movie filled. But I will have to like shove in a lot of movies in one go, you know, on one day.
Well, if you're good at anything, it's shoving it in. You know, I think that I don't know what that even means, Dean. I'm sorry.
I don't.
I mean, it could be a great year for Robert Redford, man. I mean, judging from the reviews this movie has gotten and the great trailer that came out for it, I mean, he could be up for Best Actor and be a serious front runner for it.
Yeah,
I think he is the front runner. I think he's the person to beat. I'll say that right now. I think that movie looks tremendous. I think that it's going to be a very challenging. I mean, it's obviously physically challenging. You know, the fact that he's, you know, performing at all, you know, with very little words. He hasn't been nominated since 1973 for The Sting, and not for acting at least. And I think he might have a lot of sentimental, you know, weight thrown behind him. I think he's the one to beat this year.
I'm still waiting for that trailer for the new McConaughey movie. And if that looks good, then I think that's a real race between he and Redford for Best Actor.
Mm-hmm.
Dean, you saw Spectacular Now, and you've discussed it before on the show, but before I play this interview, tell what your connection with the film's director is.
I was the film festival programmer for a film festival in North Georgia called the Dahlonega International Film Festival at the beginning of, well, I did it from 2001 to 2004, little ways into 2004. Anyway, in 2002, I believe, he had a film that I really loved called Coming Down the Mountain, which was about a gentleman who was dispensing prescription pills to various people around the around this rural community, and then meanwhile his son is going through some substance abuse problems as well. So it's a 20-minute drama, and it was really beautifully done, and it was directed by James Ponsold, of course, and I had met James, and I ended up nominating his film for the best dramatic short, and so we became friends, you know, pretty early on. So he's one of the few people out of, and the film festival was really great. It was a great experience. And there were a lot of great films, but he's really the only director out of many who's really gone on and who's made a name for himself. And so I've just been watching his career pretty intently for throughout this past decade. So,
well, The Spectacular Now is now in limited release, and his next movie is actually the Hillary Clinton biopic.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the one that they just cast Diane Lane in.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken. Anyway, The Spectacular Now, it's an eagerly awaited movie, and it is out on limited release now, as is a movie titled The Artist and the Model, which is from a great filmmaker by the name of Fernando Trieba, and he won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film for Belle Epoque, and also got nominated for Chico and Rita. It might have been last year that was nominated for animated film. The Artist and the Musical is currently playing in Los Angeles. I'm sure it will expand wider in the weeks ahead. First here, you'll hear from James Ponsoldt about The Spectacular Now, and then Fernando will take the stage in this segment. Enjoy.
What about, ex-boyfriends? Say, we need an ex-boyfriend in there.
No, I don't have
Who's an ex-boyfriend that just, like, really piss you off, that you just, that just, like, you hate it? And if they're just, like...
I don't have an ex-boyfriend.
What?
Yeah.
You don't have a single... You're 17 years old. You don't have an ex-boyfriend?
No.
Really?
Guys don't look
That's
at me
shocking.
Like that.
Yeah, absolutely, guys look at you like
no,
that.
No, no,
I just saw two guys looking at you like that. Eric Wolf and Cody Dennis
were
100%
hitting
on
you. No, they were not hitting on me. No, there's absolutely
yes,
no way.
Why don't you think they were hitting on you?
Because I'm just... They weren't.
Because you're what? Amy, you're absolutely beautiful.
Oh, my God, no.
I know the genesis of the project came when you got the script, and I know that in the past you've been writing your own things. You know, did you feel like it was a good idea to take a break from writing to sort of cleanse your palate? You know, in some ways.
It wasn't really like a concerted effort to do that. It was more just that the producers approached me. After Sundance 2012 when Smash was there, and they said that they liked my movie a lot and that they wanted to know if I wanted to read the script, and
mm-hmm.
And I never seriously thought about directing someone else's script before, but I did read the script because I respected Scott and Mike who wrote it, and I knew of Kim Tharp's novel, which had been nominated for the National Book Award a few years before, and I just fell in love with the script and then immediately read Tim's novel and fell in love with that too, and it was just a great story.
that, I guess, is what was really exciting to me, was the fantastic story, and who cares if I wrote it or not? I like writing,
yes.
I like directing, and it felt very natural and easy.
Speaking to the naturalness of just the entire film feels extremely real, and never forced or in any way, shape, or form. And a lot of that is due in large part to the naturalness of your cast, particularly Miles Teller and Shailene Woodley. Can you tell me about the audition process, like how you got those two actors together, and also what specific kind of directions did you give them on set to achieve that natural quality?
Well, I mean, the truth is I was a big fan of both of them before. You know, I'd seen Shailene in The Descendants, and she read the script really early, and I knew that she was a really passionate fan of the role. So she was one of the first people I met with, and we just had the longest conversation about everything. I mean, about the character and the script story, but like really about her and her life and who she was and her point of view on the world. And I really just loved her take on it. I just thought that she completely understood the DNA of this story and of this character in a way that was so refreshing. And then, you know, Miles Teller, I'd seen him in Rabbit Hole acting opposite Nicole Kidman, and he blew me away. I mean, it just felt like such an unbelievably mature performance. It wasn't showy. It wasn't histrionic. It was just really internal. It was a performance that really existed in the eyes, and it was a kid just dealing with grief. He felt like a regular kid who'd wandered into a Nicole Kidman film. And then I saw him again in Footloose, in the remake of Footloose, which is a completely different film, completely different performance, where he's just kind of totally goofy kid. But, like, I totally recognize that kid from kids that I went to high school with. And I just loved the range of Miles. I mean, and we met, and just like with Shailene, we just hung out for hours, and I got to know him and the way that he saw the world. And really, I just loved his take on it. I mean, we had pretty much every young actor you can imagine at some point probably read for those roles, but Miles and Shailene, to me, I just, once I met them, I couldn't imagine anyone else playing the parts. And, you know, I hung out with the two of them. You know, we wound up, like, going out and getting dinner and coffee, stuff like that. And just, like, their energy is so different as people, but it's so fun watching them interact with each other. And Shailene, you know, is younger than Miles, but, you know, she's kind of like an old soul, and Miles is just incredibly charismatic and makes everybody laugh. And, you know, I just hope that I could kind of capture that energy on film and not get in the way of it too much.
I know that you're a fan of movies like, you know, Breaking Away and so forth. I remember at the film festival that was brought up.
Yeah.
What is it about? Are there some other films, first of all, that, you know, you consider, you know, in that same league as Breaking Away? And also, what is it specifically about those films that speaks to you?
Well, I mean, I like films, you know, I think when people say, quote unquote, teen film or coming of age film, it can be really reductive. But I guess the ones that really stick out for me that stand the test of time, you know, they just dignify the emotional experience of the characters, and it treats them the exact same way it would if they were 6 years old or 16 or 60. And they're places that I think they're films that are aware of race and class, and where place is a big character. You watch Breaking Away, in Bloomington, Indiana is a big character in it. I feel the same way about Last Picture Show or Splendor in the Grass or Rebel Without a Cause or Days of Accused or Kez or Show Me Love or 400 Blows. You know, those are all films where I think they deal with nostalgia, but they're not sentimental, which is to say they, you know, deal with a very specific time, you know, in youth, but they're laced with a bit of bitterness and sadness. You know, there's real melancholy, and the characters really feel pain, even though there might be a lot of humor and light and warmth in the stories as well.
A lot of those movies really do touch on that sense of knowing that this is a specific time in your life, being young, and that it's kind of slipping away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking to that, is, in some ways, is your decision to shoot in Athens, Georgia, which is your hometown, right?
Yeah. You know, I was very conscious that I didn't want to put either pop culture, a lot of, you know, pop culture signifiers that would timestamp the movie as clearly, you know, 2013 and make it age badly. But I also didn't want to have the like regional signifiers of Athens in the southeast, like the most obvious ones, like here are the arches that everyone knows from EGA, or here's the REM steeple, the things that make it seem like a quote-unquote southern movie in a way that I think can alienate. You know, I think those are all really valid if part of what you're making a story about is the South or whatever region you're depicting. In this case, like when I watch Breaking Away, I know Bloomington in a little bit, and it feels very local and lived in, but it's not, you know, it doesn't alienate. It doesn't sort of underline that fact. It kind of, what's important there is that this is not a major city. It's not New York or Chicago or L.A. It's not the middle of nowhere, but these are local kids, you know, in a college town where there's like kids that are coming in from other places that maybe have more money or different experiences, you know. And so, I mean, in using Athens as a character, it's from the point of view of a teenager, you know. It's not a college kid that moved to Athens to go party, to go to school, to start a band. These are kids that still live in their parents' houses. They still have curfews, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? So they're aware of these college kids having wild experiences, but they're kind of in the suburbs, and it's kind of a you know, not huge town, and all around it, there's not that much to do, but go, you know, drink in the woods or something.
That's a great scene, the sort of kegger in the woods.
Yeah.
Nice. And particularly their conversation that comes from that scene. It's great, that sort of ice-breaking kind of conversation that they have. I really noticed, you know, from the first film that I remember seeing of yours, which was the short that was at the film festival that I programmed called Coming Down the Mountain.
Yeah.
And then in some of your other films, particularly Smashed, and I noticed also there's a theme of like, for lack of a better term, you know, like a substance abuse kind of theme. Do you see that kind of through line in some of your films? And can you tell me like what it is about that particular subject that you find interesting?
Well, I guess I just, most people I know, you know, if I get to know them well enough or just long enough, you know, I kind of start to recognize that everyone has baggage that they're dealing with, or has scar tissue, or has demons, or just, you know, everybody has complicated relationship with their parents or their ex-girlfriend or ex-husband, or, you know what I mean, with their parents or children, however you work it out. And I think people have elaborate systems of, you know, coping mechanisms, the way they get through the day. And I guess I find that really fascinating. No one's a blank slate. Everyone has a past. And everyone, you know, in their own private life, is probably very specific, and if you could get a glimpse at anyone, you know, the way that they live privately, you might think they're pretty weird, and they might think the same thing about you. And you know, mm-hmm. I don't come at that from a place of judgment. I just find that really fascinating. I just find human behavior really compelling.
You ever see yourself returning to the South to film again? And I'd also like kind of your opinion on how the South is portrayed in films and what you think, you know, that could be done better in that realm.
I mean, I would love to make plenty more movies in the South. I mean, I love the South. It's where I'm from. It's where my parents live, still live in Athens, Georgia. My sister lives in Decatur, Georgia. I have family in Florida, a lot of family in Florida. So it's what I know best.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as a location as a character, it's like shorthand for me, and it's kind of inside me. So absolutely, I'd love to make more stuff down there. As far as how it's depicted, I mean, I think there are filmmakers who are really great at doing regional filmmaking and doing the South, who made a lot of films that I love. People like John Sayles or Victor Nunez or Terrence Malick or Julie Dash or Ross McElwee. I love their take on it. And then there's a lot of really horrible, totally offensive depictions of the South that really are broad stroke and kind of cliche and reduce the South to like bad accents and Civil War reenactments, which I have very little interest or patience for because I find it insulting. So I guess, you know, whenever I'm going to set a story in the South, I just hope to make it really specific to the experiences of characters and not make a big conceptual piece about the quote-unquote South, which I think is mm-hmm. when you get into murky territory, when people want to try to really get at the soul of the place and they wind up just sounding like jerks.
with the spectacular now, it has this. It definitely has this amazing timeless look to it. Like this, it's not just about the fact that there's not a lot of texting going on or cell phones being seen. There's, you know, it's obviously taking place today, but the look of the film, this is, it's got this sort of burnished look to it, and it's also got very specific kind of art direction choices that make it seem incredibly timeless. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you arrived at that?
You know, it was a big conversation from the get-go with everyone, with the production designer, with the art director, cinematographer, you know, hair and makeup, even in the casting, you know, with music supervisor, composer, everything. It was really that, you know, a lot of the films that I think of from, say, the earlier mid-80s, when you rewatch them, it's so hard to not be taken out of the film by, say, music choices or by certain wardrobe, things that we're trying to capture, that probably were trying to capture the zeitgeist of the moment, but really made the film feel dated very quickly. And, you know, the actual experience I have, or that I had growing up in Georgia, and my wife helps run a school right now, is that, you know, kids, you know, unless you're growing up, like, in Manhattan or L.A. or something like that, you know, in a big city, you're not constantly wearing, like, trendy new clothes. You might be wearing hand-me-downs. You might get something from the Walmart or the mall. You probably have new clothes at the beginning of the school year, but the end of the school year, they're kind of worn out a little bit. You know, so I wanted to capture that sense, you know, which I think speaks to class and economics. You know, and I was really interested in the emotional inner lives of the characters and not things that would come off as fads. So easy pop culture signifiers we really wanted to remove. We didn't want it to seem like a period piece, but, you know, I wanted to have a textured look and feel. A lot of that came to, you know, that we'd shoot it on anamorphic 35, use natural light, you know, a lot of the look and feel that, like, a lot of it could feel like it's happening in 2013 or 1993 or 83 or 75. And, you know, I wanted the movie in that way to exist out of time and be more about the relationship and the characters.
I know that, didn't you say, I think I remember you saying at the film festival that it's your first film in anamorphic. Is that the case?
Actually, Off the Black, my first feature, we shot on anamorphic 35 as well. Yeah, so it was my second feature on anamorphic 35, which I love. Smash, my last one, was on the Alexa, which is a great, you know, it's a great tool. They're all tools. I'm not a Luddite who only wants to shoot on film. I think every film has specific needs, but no, I love widescreen 35.
Is there a specific different kind of visual sense that you have to bring to a widescreen movie as opposed to a 1:8:5 ratio?
Yeah, I mean, you just have more frame to, like, you know, to have characters exist in a space and not just be anywhere. I think the difference between television and film, so much of, I mean, obviously 1 hour dramatic television is getting more cinematic, but traditionally TV is about the medium close-up and the close-up, and it's just like, you know, make your stars, frame them well and make them look nice. Whereas film, you can really, you know, you can dwarf your characters. You can have them relate to a space and have, when, you know, and acknowledge that it's wildly different growing up in Manhattan than it is growing up in, say, the rural deep south. And it's just, you know, all the more ability to do that. And it allows you to put more thought into the blocking of the characters. And, you know, just give a real sense of environment, which is really compelling.
Yeah.
I mean, depth of field is obviously different as well. And you can really just draw the focus of the audience to specific things in a very different way.
So are you able to talk about your next project yet, or do you know what that is?
Yeah, I'll tell you. You know, I'm writing a couple things. I'm working on an adaptation of the musical Pippin, and I'm also adapting this sci-fi book called Pure that I'll direct. And I'm going to direct a script that I didn't write, called Rodham, which is about the young Hillary Rodham in the 1970s in D.C. So those are kind of the things that are taking my time right now, and just kind of just trying to support the spectacular now as much as I can. I've been going to a lot of film festivals with it.
The inspiration for this film had been, you've been living with it for quite some time. When did the inspiration for it first strike you?
I start to think about that in the 90s, and I think it started when I put together some things from the last years of Picasso with some things of the last years of Aristide Maillol. I think when I put together these two things, Picasso's obsession with the artist and the model subject and old age and youth and life and death, and Aristide Maillol's last years working in the Pyrenees during the occupation with Dina Vierney, then I decided I wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, since so much of this film has to do with growing older and finding that last grasp of inspiration, I'm wondering how you think this movie would have been different if you had made it in the 90s when you first conceived of it. Do you think it would have been a much different film?
I can't answer that, really, because I can't know. But it's true that for years I was postponing this project, thinking that I was too young for that movie, no, and that the older I was, the better. Because you always have, I need to have some strong empathy with the characters, and how can you understand a character who is 80 years old when you are 30 or whatever, no? The closest you are to that, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to know, because you have two exceptional performances, two lead performances in this film, and it's a great central relationship. What kind of tone did you want to establish, and how did you go about establishing that tone on the set?
Yeah, I was looking for something that the artist is looking to, and he talks a lot about in the movie, who is natural and natural. And it can be confusing. There is a line by Robert Bresson in his only book where he's talking about acting, about actors, and they say that some actors, they have natural, but they lack nature. So what I was looking for was a tone who was not natural in the sense of believable, but natural in the sense of nature, of true, of the real thing. Do you understand what I mean? I don't know if my English is...
I understand completely. I mean, the artist's medium, in order to find the truth of something, it's not necessarily finding the most natural way of portraying. So tell me about choosing your cast with Jean and Ada. How did you go about finding them?
Yeah, I must say that I always thought of them for that movie. Ada did her first movie when she was 14 with me. I found her after a long casting in a movie called Shanghai Spell in 2001. And then when I started thinking about this movie, I thought she could be perfect for that part. And also, I always thought about Jan, because I wanted someone who was at the same time strong and fragile. And I wanted someone who was at the same time grave and ironic. And vulnerable and human and tender, but strong. And I think all these qualities are in Jan. So I was very lucky that he liked the script and accepted being in the movie, because, yeah, for me it was the perfect actor for that.
Well, is it true that he told you that he was getting ready to retire, so he should do your film as soon as possible?
Yeah, he told me when he read the script, he told me, I want this movie to be my last one. And I say, oh my God, why did you say that? And He said, I was looking for the right part for closing my career, and I want to keep on producing, writing, and doing other things, but it's, the actor's work is too exhausting for a man of my age. And I said to him, but maybe someone is going to offer something beautiful that you would like, and you are going to do it for sure. And he told me, well, if there is a script that I love and a character that I love, and a director that as a human being I love, not just as a director, but as a human being that I can establish a human relationship with him, then I will accept. But he says, at my age, these three things together is not easy.
Yeah, it's not really easy at any age to find that great, perfect combination. But this seems like such a terrific, if this is his last performance, it's a very poetic one. It's a beautiful, beautiful closing statement. And the film is shot in gorgeous black and white. What was the thinking behind the black and white palette?
You know, when I was young and I wanted to be an artist, a painter when I was young, and I idolized, especially Picasso was a god in my youth. And it still is. And the images and the photographs of his atelier of Picasso working, or even the photographs of David Douglas Duncan of the empty atelier without nobody there, just the atelier, the works, and also the Brassai portraits of Picasso. All these images for me were like dream images, no? I fantasized with them when I was a boy. So my head and my memory was full of all these images who were in black and white. And in the origin of that movie is also the idea of making a movie who takes place mostly in this beautiful landscape that is for me the artist's atelier.
Right.
So I never thought I could make that in color. Then many artists who saw the movie told me the black and white is perfect because the for the body, for the volume of the sculptures, it works much better than coloring. Color will be not as good, and they are right. But and I agree with them. But in my initial idea of this movie, it was always black and white because of all these images that I saw when I was young, not that belongs to my life.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that, I mean, the big thing that impresses me about the film is it's actually dealing with these big themes, which not enough movies do these days, I think. I mean, you're dealing with themes from life and death and beauty and love and art. Why do you think that film is the perfect medium to explore these big themes?
Because in cinema is an art of storytelling. And I think in cinema you can tell us a story about that and communicate feelings about that without using capital letters, without using big words and or concepts and ideas, but doing it through the eyes of the characters, through the light, through the way they look to each other, creating an atmosphere, no? It's in a more narrative way, no? Not in a pompous or pretentious way, who could have been the danger when you are talking about issues like that, no? I don't want this movie to be pretentious at all, no? I wanted to talk about the humility, the humble side of being an artist, working with your hands and trying and searching for something.
Okay, that was James Ponsoldt. His new film is titled The Spectacular Now, which is spectacularly now in limited release. And Fernando Treba, his film The Artist and the Model, is currently playing in Los Angeles. So thank you to them both for taking part in our show. Okay, let's close off with a list, as we always do. This is from tasteofcinema.com. This is a list of the 20 most hated movies ever made.
Oh, I love this list. This list drove me nuts.
Oh, good. I like it when you're driven nuts. Tellingly, most of the movies in this list are recent. They made no bad movies pre-1995 or so, according to this.
Wow.
So here we go. Number 20, Sex and the City 2.
Never saw it.
A typical review associated with Sex and the City 2. Here's something from Rotten Tomatoes. A horrible movie with nothing to offer other than the envy of being in Abu Dhabi. Honestly, I should have never even entered the cinema room to watch this. Oh, my God. What a terrible review. Fuck that. I will edit that out. Okay. Number
the cinema room.
The cinema
room. What are we in 1902?
I should have pre-read that. The flickering images. The picture show was... they're number 19. God. Their number 19 is The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Again, another...
Yeah, it sucks.
Neither one of these movies I bothered to watch, I have to say.
Number 18. Now, this is a movie that belongs on here. You know, in the history of movies, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen doesn't even make a blip. But something like Battlefield Earth was considered a catastrophe, for all involved.
Yeah.
Yes, and that was truly a terrible movie. I mean, you know, no question about it. And, you know, it's hated for many other reasons than just it being a bad movie. It's also, you know, the Scientology aspect of it and so forth. So that's definitely a movie that deserves to be on the list, I think.
Number 17, Neil Abute's The Wicker Man.
These all suck so far.
Isn't that movie, though, one of those movies that's so bad it's great?
No,
not great, but you know what I mean. Like it's really funny. Like it's really bad, so bad that it's funny.
There are movies like that, but I think with The Wicker Man, people just laugh. People just want to see the highlight clips, the 10-minute highlight clips, so they can laugh at it.
Uh-huh.
Nobody actually wants to sit through that movie again.
I don't want to sit through it again. It's bad enough I saw it. I mean, all right, go on to what's next. I mean.
16 X-Men: The Last Stand, the Brett Ratner. I don't think it's
really. I wouldn't put that on there. No, that doesn't belong on there.
Number 15 for them is Alien vs. Predator.
Well, I mean that film sucks. I mean both of those films suck because they do what you know. It's very rare that you can do that to a film where you can destroy two franchises in one film.
Number 14 is Highlander 2, The Quickening, which awful subtitle, The Quickening.
The Quickening.
But yeah, it does belong on there, and I'll tell you why. Because the first film is actually very good, and then they go on to this horrible tangent. The first film is a decent film, is a fun film.
Number 13, Ang Lee's The Hulk or Hulk.
No. That's not belong
on
here.
Some people are going back with The Hulk and actually saying that it's actually not as bad as I mean, I haven't seen it, but some people are trying to be a little revisionist about that film.
It's got too much visual imagination going for it. I mean, it's going for something different. you know, and so.
No, it's a good film. And, you know, the more you think about it, the more, I mean, yeah, 10 years ago when I saw it, I wasn't crazy about it, but the more you think about it, you actually step back and, I got to give Ang Lee credit for trying to do something new.
Mm-hmm. Number 12, Catwoman.
Man, these,
I would have put it up at two.
But I mean, you know, that movie was terrible, no question about it.
Number 11, Lady in the Water.
I mean, that's like shooting fish in a barrel with it. I mean, he deserves his own list.
Number 10,
yeah,
The Happening. The Happening. So he clearly has his own list.
Well, you got two on there, and they're both pretty bad. I mean, they're both really bad. But The Happening is actually, yeah, The Happening definitely deserves to be on it.
Yeah, much more than Lady in the Water.
Lady in the Water had some things, you know, some good things about it. I mean, I didn't love it, but
yeah, me too.
But it had something going for it at least. So
it did. I mean, it had something in there, you know.
Number 9, The Last Airbender. You see,
oh my God,
okay,
3 in a row! Wow.
Yeah. Number 8, Die Another Day. You know, I don't know that people like this movie. It's not a very good movie, but who talks about it? Nobody talks about, oh, God, I hated that movie. It ruined Bond. You know, it doesn't have that.
Right.
It didn't ruin Bond. It was a standard James Bond movie. It's just that ruined Bond. If that ruined Bond for you, you hadn't been paying attention for the last, 40 years. I'm sorry.
House of the Dead, number 7, the Uwe Boll movie.
Oh, that's just, who gives a shit? Come on.
Number 6.
Okay.
Number 6. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. That was the second one, right? The incoherent one?
That's the second one. But my question is, all right, this is already game. I mean, House of the Dead, who the fuck saw House of the Dead? But Revenge of the Fallen, everyone, you know, look. That was Revenge of the Fallen. I actually think the third Transformers movie is the one to beat, but really, Revenge of the Fallen? Oh, because they had the two Transformers that talked in the ghettoese? Oh, give me a break.
Number 5, you know, number 5 is along with Battlefield Earth. That's what this list should be. That movies that maintain some level of infamy for being hated.
Mm-hmm.
Every
yeah.
other movie on this list has not fit that bill yet. But their number 5, Batman and Robin, certainly does.
No.
I would throw that one in there. Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're getting to number 4. Perhaps this belongs on here, yes. Number 4 is Gus Van Sant's Psycho remake.
Oh,
is it really hated, though? I mean,
people hated it before it came out. I mean,
they hate the idea of it. But
it's a bad movie, you know. It is a bad movie. But it's a bad movie because it just sucks.
Well, I would say this. If you try and just divorce yourself from the fact that Psycho's already been made and it's a thing, and you try and look at it for what he was kind of trying to do with it, and I think it was a real self-serving reason why he did that film, I don't think that it's one of the worst ever made. I mean, you know, it's the idea of it that people
it's,
hate.
It's
most
one of the
well.
Most hated movies ever made. Then that's what this list is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, you know, I like Gus Van Sant's Psycho, actually. I thought it was a worthy experiment that was fascinating. It wasn't successful in the least. But it was at least fascinating, and it's an experiment that really excited me. So I didn't think it was blasphemous. But I do
mm-hmm.
concede that is an incredibly hated movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Their number 3 is Twilight, hated by the male population, I would imagine, is what they
yeah.
are. Their number 2, you know, the 2 and 1 probably belong on this list. Number 2 is Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm. No
yeah.
argument there.
Yeah, that's a hated film.
And number 1, which I don't think it's worthy of the other entries in the series, but I think there's a lot of great stuff in it. So I don't think it's a completely worthless movie, but people generally hate it, is Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Wow, that's number one. Wow.
I wouldn't put, I mean, but people didn't like that film, and, you know, I didn't care for it myself, although I thought some parts of it were kind of fun, but I didn't think it was the worst, even the worst film of that year. So,
yeah, they're not ranking the worst films ever made, though. I mean, that's not what
they're saying. Yeah, I know. They're talking, what they're talking about here, what they're really talking about is all the little fanboys getting together and saying, "Ooh, I hate that movie." So it's those people who are saying, "I hate the movie." That's what they're talking about.
And they all sound like Jerry Lewis when they do it. That's
yeah, right. So
hang on, Dean. I got a sound clip for you.
Ooh, you. But, you know, what's funny about this list, too, is as we've already mentioned, you know, it has no sense of history to it. They didn't try and research it. They didn't even try and go back and just simply Google worst movies ever and, like, come up with some kind of thing about, you know, The Conqueror, the Howard Hughes movie, or you know, Man of
Well,
the
here's
State,
the, here,
or
Myra
Breckenridge.
Or even movies that have had a critical reassessment. I mean, you could say that Heaven's Gate was a very hated movie when it first came out, and you could put that on a list, and you wouldn't be wrong, but it's being reassessed right now as we speak.
Right.
You know, and there's some people that would put something like Birth of a Nation on that list. But
exactly.
Here is something, though, and a reason why I think maybe the currency, not as in money, but being current, of this list is relevant. In that we live in an age where we can spew hate a lot more readily than we could before. I mean, the reputation of a movie can die with a tweet, you know. So I think that's a big reason, too, why a lot of modern films belong on the list, because that sense of hatred of some of these movies was widespread in, like, record time, whereas you didn't necessarily get that back then in the Birth of a Nation time.
Yeah, but it makes for a really boring list, if you ask me, and not an authoritative list, and not a list that should be called, for fuck's sake, the 20 most hated movies of all time. It's just not, I mean, if you wanted to say the 20 most hated movies of the internet era or of the last 20 years.
Well, and that's why we like to give them time on our show. All right. What song do you want to end the show with? What have we talked about this show where we could tie in with a closing song?
We did talk about musicals and making Animal House into a musical. So how about the theme to Animal House?
That has a theme? Does it have a theme song or something?
Yeah, it has a theme song. It's played over the closing credits, and it's done by Stephen Bishop.
Well, I don't think we have that, though. So why don't
good
we?
Good old Stephen Bishop. I love Stephen Bishop, man.
Well,
I
it's
do.
Probably on YouTube. You can get it.
I love Stephen Bishop's Tootsie song. That's my favorite Stephen Bishop right there. All right, I'll look up Animal House, and if we don't have that, then I'll play something equally as horrendous.
Just look up Animal House theme song. And
I know what
you're sure it will. I'm sure it will pop up.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. All right, guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Talk to you later.
Bye, guys.
All right. Good night. Bye-bye.